Good morning. Hope everyone had a good first day yesterday with the panel and the Cubs game and then the concert last night. I think everyone seemed to enjoy that. So
I missed the concert.
Looking forward to a really fun day today. We've got a really interesting and, have to use the word, fun panel on tap here, and I will let Barry Bloom tell you a little bit more about it, but first let me introduce Barry. Barry's been a longtime friend, longtime baseball writer. He's the national columnist for MLB.com. He's joined us before as a moderator, and he's going to be moderating today's panel. Today's panel is called Curveballs, Pitching Prodigies, Real and Imagined, and there's a lot to be imagined there, and I'll let him tell you a little more about it. And just want to let everyone know, again, we're keeping with the same pattern we use with questions, so there will be note cards at each end there. If you just go there, there are pens and note cards. If you put your question there and then just leave it on the table, someone will come get it, and then in the last 15 minutes, we'll have questions. So now I'm going to turn it over to Barry.
Hey, good morning. What a great crowd this morning. Fantastic. Looked like Wrigley Field yesterday. Sold out. Love it. This is a pretty much concocted story. I have to my left and your right a man you may have heard of but may not have, and we'll explain the story. 30 years ago, Sports Illustrated did a story on an incredible phenom who had just been discovered by the Mets called Sid Finch. And this is Joe over here, who he posed as Sid Finch. And he was an art school professor or teacher at a middle school here in Chicago, and a photography assistant to Lane Stewart, who shot the piece. And it's an amazing thing, because we were talking about it, and the situation was that there's no Twitter, no internet, no ESPN back then, and there were so many people involved in the Met organization and all the way across that it's amazing to me that everybody kept it quiet and nobody leaked the fact that this was a hoax. And after the story came out, for 3 days, everybody believed that the Mets had come out with this phenom who could throw 168 miles an hour. And George Plimpton wrote the story. And there's an ESPN 3030 special on this that ran recently. And in the story, basically, he says, well, I wanted to make it 138 miles an hour, and I made a mistake. It was 168. And the editor, Mark Mulvoy, wanted to leave it that way. And they go, well, where'd you come up with 168? Well, that's the speed of the Shinkansen or the bullet train in Japan. To my right here, for Cub fans and White Sox fans, really need no introduction. This is big left-handed pitcher Steve Trout. He won 88 games in his career for four teams, the White Sox, the Cubs, the Yankees for a year, and he says there's a tremendous story about that. He was starting to get into it. He finished your career with the Seattle Mariners, right?
That's right.
And but his best year was 13-8 for the 1984 Cubs, which was also a concocted team. And I think it's interesting, you know, Dallas Green came from Philadelphia, and he had a falling out with the Phillies after they won the 1980 World Series. 1981, they make the playoffs, get eliminated by Montreal, and he leaves in a huff. He becomes general manager of the Cubs. And it's at that time, who wants to become general manager of the Cubs? So Dallas comes in and basically rebuilds the Cubs mostly with old Phillies. I mean, if you look at the Cubs from 84, there's one guy of their main guys who came through the system, and that was Lee Smith. Everybody else came from somewhere else, and the Cubs were filled with Boa Sandberg, Dick Ruthven, Bob Denier, Gary Matthews, Keith Moreland. These were all his guys, Sandberg, who were on the 1980 and 77, 78 teams that won there. So, I mean, that's the way he rebuilt. And, of course, you know, for Steve came from the White Sox. The pitching staff was Rich Sutcliffe, Steve, Scott Sanderson, Dennis Eckersley, and Dick Ruthven. All of them were for somewhere else. And the the beauty of this all and how it all interlinks is even in the Eckersley trade where they got him from Boston, who's the guy that goes to Boston? A first baseman named Bill Buckner, who 2 years later lets the ball through his legs in the famous game that that Mets won the World, went on to win the World Series. So you have a wedge here where you have the 84 Cubs, April Fool's Day of 1985 when the Sid Finch story came out, and the Mets, who were just starting to build, and in fact, I think won 100 games in 1985, but lost to the Cardinals, who won 102. And then 86, they run away with it, but have to fight tooth and nail in the NLCS to the last pitch of the NLCS, last pitch of the World Series, to finally win. And that's the whole wedge of the whole story with all these guys involved. So what I want to start with is, let's start with Joe, who basically becomes involved in this story just on a cursory basis, and now is this guy, Sid Finch. Joe?
This guy.
This guy.
Yeah. It's great to be here with baseball fans. I mean, I'm a big Cubs fan. I live out in Oak Park. And my involvement with the story started with a friend of mine, Lane Stewart, who's a staff photographer with Sports Illustrated. Lane's done Sportsman of the Year shots of Jack Nicklaus, Pete Rose, a great shot of George Stoudemire. We were talking about George earlier. So you would know his work. I would help out assisting Lane on stories, particularly if they had a Chicago connection. So as a photographer, you might get a paid assistant, and that was my involvement with Lane. Boondoggles, these trips to cover sports people. Lane would usually do people, not events. So that was his focus with the magazine. And with my love of baseball, Lane always tried to get me into a spring training baseball story. So we did Calvin Griffith with the Twins the spring before, going down there. I always liked the optimism of spring training. So in the middle of March in 1985, Lane called and said, I've got a story with the Mets. Now, the Mets had just signed Gary Carter. We were following the 84 Cubs and knew it great. Lane said, we've got this story on this pitching phenomenon. He's got 168-mile-hour fastball. I always knew Lane got his sports facts messed up, so I just kind of let that slip by. He's got a connection with Tibet. He perfected his fastball by throwing rocks at snow leopards. And His only possessions are a food bowl and a Tibetan rug, and he plays the French horn. I said, well, I've never heard of this guy. You know, are you kidding? I've never heard of this guy. Well, what do you think? Are you in on the story? Do you want to do it? I said, yeah, the Mets and Cubs, same division. I'm always good for a baseball story. I'm in. And he goes, well, get yourself a French horn, get yourself a food bowl and a Tibetan rug, and meet me in St. Petersburg. So that was our involvement. We had a printout from George Plimpton. George had met with Mark Mulvoy, the managing editor at the time of Sports Illustrated. And they talked about doing a story on baseball hoaxes. And through that conversation, it came out that Plimpton would try to write his own April Fool's story. So he put some thoughts together. And when Lane and I, we met down in St. Petersburg then, we had a printout of George's story. We didn't know if the story was just going to be a single column with one of those distant shots, but we had Nelson Doubleday's approval to have the run of the Mets. So Nelson Doubleday at the time was George Plimpton's publisher, so they knew each other socially. We went down there, and Jay Horowitz, who was still with the Mets, arranged for me to get a uniform and all the proper equipment. We were asked why number 21. When I was waiting in line for the uniforms, I had a roster of the spring training guys, and my first uniform was 45. I looked on the roster, and 45 already had some guy's name on it. I didn't want a name on the roster, so I looked down, and 21. There was no 21 on the roster and no name. So 21, there's a mystical sense to 21. Everybody remembers turning 21. So I took 21, and little did we know it become such a known thing. But we had 4 days with the Mets, complete run of spring training, but we played it really low key. Spring training is not like it is today. I mean, back then you would just show up and you could kind of do your own thing. However, when I'm walking around with a French horn and work boots and a rug under my arm, with the real Mets guys, and we're going base to base with Bobby Valentine and Davey Johnson. And, you know, he's saying, take the secondary lead. And I'm thinking, man, this is just like working with my little league kids. You know, but here I'm with the real life baseball guys. So for a baseball nut, it was fantastic.
Right. And you should note that part of the Sid Finch aura was that he pitched with one foot bare and another foot with a work boot. And there's a picture of just the feet in the story that Lane Stewart takes. And then, Steve, my understanding is that you guys all met each other because you were waiting online to buy a copy and get a copy of Plimpton's book signed. Was this the book that he wrote eventually on the Finch Experience?
Yes, but we were on a flight when I read this in Sports Illustrated, and I said, thank God the Mets got him and the Cubs didn't sign him. Because I was only throwing 68. But yeah, that's how Joe and I met. You want to tell that little story?
We were down. After the story came out, then it was just such a huge hit. Lane and I really had no idea it was going to be a big deal. So we ended up talking our way into a lot of different scenarios down there. Mel Stottlemyre was fantastic. We always worked with the younger kids at the time because they'd go along, they'd cooperate. Lenny Dykstra was a young guy with the Mets at the time. Kevin Mitchell, Dwight Gooden was, I think, still only 19 or 20.
Yeah, it was his 85 was his first
so,
year.
So it was fantastic working with the young guys. And so with the Lane would try to get me into these situations. So there was a minor league game going on, and I'm on the sidelines with Dwight Gooden and Kevin Mitchell and my French horn, and I'm looking at Lane. Lane's going, get closer to him. So I'm walking up, and I'm sitting down with a French horn now between those guys. And Kevin Mitchell's grabbing my French horn, and he's how do you play this thing? I go, man, I did it. Well, here, I'm blowing a few notes out. Then he takes it away. He's squealing notes out of this French horn. And there's a game going on, and Davey Johnson's looking, what the hell's going on down there? So I'm trying to grab the French horn from him.
Funny in itself because Kevin Mitchell couldn't read or write trying to play the French horn.
Well, there are musicians who don't know how to read music. So.
No, I'm talking about really read or write.
So Mitchell's he's putting up a fight on this. I go, Kevin, I can't get thrown out of here. You know, you got a day job here, but I can't mess up this story. So funny things like that. So I go back then to teaching the next day. You know, so the kids are sitting there, you know, how was your weekend? And I have no idea how big of a story this is going to be. Lane then follows up. He's doing more shots in New York. He's got a toy soldier friend of ours who's going to be the Buddhist monk expert in the story. He goes to Harvard to shoot a room where was my classroom before I disappeared to Tibet. So he's doing real shots to finish that up. And then he presents the carousel of slides at the end of that week to George Plimpton and Mark Mulvoy. And included in that are some shots of us that we did in Egypt the winter before.
Plimpton, because you knew each other and you traveled with each other.
Right, so we happened to be in Egypt the same time. So Lane's got me on camels and with an Egyptian family and all that. So great stuff. Plimpton can't believe it. So he's going back to build up more and more of the story. Mulvoy's saying, well, look, it's so good we'll knock some advertisers out of this. This is fantastic. This we'll have good fun with it. Well, I didn't know any of that was going on. Then Lane calls and says, Joe, you know, get ready. They're making a big deal about this. So when the story hit, and again, we alluded to the 168, what's believable in that. We thought 168, we really thought we were just going to have fun with it. No one was actually going to believe it. And the way the magazine worked with Sports Illustrated, you would do early release issues to AP, and People Magazine was in the same office, and then the real print run would start that Monday. And Lane, whose wife was an editor at People, Lane got a call from the sports guy at People Magazine, really upset that how come he didn't get tipped off on Sid. And now Lane's realizing, you know, that people are actually going to fall for this. So the story comes out in New York on the Monday, and the town goes crazy. And the magazine isn't even prepared on how to handle it. And Senator Dan Moynihan, the New York senator at the time, his staff calls up Sports Illustrated, and he basically, look, I'm making bets. You guys stand by this story, right? And the secretary said, yeah.
Oh, and also, don't leave out the part that the crux of the story is this guy is so aloof that he's told the Mets, I'm not sure if I want to pitch or not, and I will make a decision by April 1st. So they have this this guy throwing 168, who they've built a canvas, and only a few people have seen pitch. And they bring, you know, Ron Reynolds, the catcher, in there, and, you know, allegedly to catch the 168-mile fastballs, and he gets blown away.
We've got a picture of Ron holding his hand as if it's just been
right,
it's injured. So he's
so they're all in on it. And then so the whole question then becomes, how do we talk Sid Finch into actually pitching for the Mets when Sid Finch doesn't exist? And so that's the whole hook on the whole story.
So Tuesday, then, the story hits, and of course the Mets are still in spring training. They've got another week. They don't break camp until April 1st. So now reporters are tracking down Mel Stottlemyre in camp. And they're going up to Mel at 8 o'clock, you know, where's Sid? You know, we're trying to find Sid. Should have been here at 5 o'clock. He works out early. You guys missed him. So Mel's just keeping a perfect straight face. Stoudemire was fantastic.
Oh, great comeback for Mel. Oh.
Guys got to get up early. You know, you missed the whole thing.
That's great.
So, yeah, so to illustrate how many people really believe this, the reporters who are covering the Mets go to Jay and they complain, how come George Plimpton got the story and we didn't?
The scoop.
And Jay tells them, well, I guess George Plimpton is a better reporter than you guys. And Plimpton, for those who don't know, was an eloquent writer, but he was like this participatory journalist. It's probably something nobody would be allowed to do today, but they let him quarterback in the NFL. They let him play goalie in hockey. He was always involved in something, and then writing a story about his engagement in it, and he had a very simple, eloquent style. And, you know, this whole thing comes whole cloth out of his head. And even Peter Ueberroth, who's the commissioner at the time, says he gets calls from two general managers who ask him, what are we going to do about Sid Finch? This is how it sunk in. So back to...
So that story travels geographically. So Monday, Tuesday, New York's going crazy about it. Then I'm getting calls at school on Wednesday. And this magazine, if you lived in this area, you'd get it in the mail on Thursday.
Oh,
Thursday.
Didn't you say your kids also asked you if you were leaving?
Yeah, so Wednesday, one of my students says, so, Mr. Burton, does this mean you're not going to be our teacher anymore? I go, what are you talking about? And he said, well, that whole thing you did with the Mets, I can't believe you're going to leave us? Well, I hadn't seen the magazine yet. So I go to the local 7-Eleven, and I picked like the third magazine from the back, and I pull it out. There's 16 pages. Some of you might remember the opening picture with the wind up with the Coke cans and such. But so then Chicago makes a big deal about it. And some of the Cub reporters call, and they're tracking down Sid at my school in Oak Park. And, you know, we found Sid. He's throwing pots and not fastballs. And so crazy, crazy stuff. Then the Mets call. Now they want to be all friendly. You know, so Sid, can you come down for April 1st? We're having a Sid Finch Day. We've got T-shirts, we've got bands, we've got the reporters coming. Sid, can you make it? You know? So even the Mets didn't know how big of a deal it was going to be. So it's become.
So you met Steve. Explain the story about how you guys hooked up.
Yeah, so we do the April 1st thing. I agree to go down there for the Mets on one condition. This time I get to keep the uniform. Now you baseball. Sure, Sid, whatever you want. So we go down there, and Plimpton wrote a press release about my retirement from baseball, and we've got ABC News there. And speaking into this mic, it reminded me of that. I had this vision of Lou Gehrig because it was this revibration of this stupid thing and T-shirts, and I'm. doing a baseball Walter Mitty, not really believing any of this is going on. So we're reading that statement, and I go walking off, and now kids are coming down wanting autographs. And Sid, sign this. And a young kid hands me a baseball, and it's got Gary Carter's autograph on it. I don't want to mess up your baseball. And Gary Carter's in front of me. He goes, sign the ball, Sid. So we work our way down, and they had great fun with that. And soon after that, I got to know Plimpton really pretty well after that whole story. But Steve and I met then at University of Chicago when George came to town for a book signing. And we would get together on events of that sort. So I'm waiting around after the signing. We're going to have a drink down there. And here's Steve, 84 Mets, 84 Cubs, in line to get a book signed. So we started
Which
up a conversation.
Was it? Do you remember?
He had just finished his biography on Truman Capote.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Steve and I ended up talking. I was so thrilled to meet a baseball player that knew about museums in major cities, baseball literature. We're talking authors. I mean, we are at the University of Chicago. But the fact that Steve was so enlightened on cultural events, in addition to just knowing him in his baseball career, it was fantastic.
I had to do everything I could to get rid of that stigma that I was a lot like Sid Finch. So I had to follow great authors like George Plimpton around. But the beer, going out for the beer, that's what really got me to hang out. A guy had gotten a ring with Sonny Liston, and the things he had done, it really enticed me to go meet him and then to share some time and then to come all the way back now, full circle, so to speak. Here we are talking about it. And I didn't know all the great parts of this whole story.
So we met there, and I said, well, we're getting drinks afterwards. Come on with us. So we hung out for a couple of hours and telling stories. And George, he died in 2003, but he had such a fascinating career in doing participatory journalism. But one of the books of his I'd recommend is called The Best of Plimpton, and it's a compilation of a lot of his shorter stories that he did for Sports Illustrated or The New Yorker. Fantastic. So it's broken down with politicians and sports people and such. But you can find that on ABE, one of the used book sites, for not too much.
Yeah, Steve, and the other thing about it is, in this era where you have bloggers and people don't come to the ballpark and, you know, there's a whole different ethos on how you cover the game, there was a great amount. I mean, when I broke in, my first year was 1976, and I wanted to be George Plimpton, I wanted to be Bob Verdi. There were so many great writers all over the country. Why don't you explain to the people what that was like at that time as a player and have some of these guys around?
Well, I came up, I signed in 76 out of high school, and I was drafted number one by the White Sox from Thornwood High School, and I wasn't even around. Imagine that, a number one, eighth pick in the country, not being around, ready to grab the phone to hear about being drafted. I was 10,000 feet above sea level in the Spanish Peaks in Bozeman, Montana. And then after 13 years playing ball, he said I never did come down from that mountaintop. But I was very fortunate, I must say, because my dad, Paul Dizzy Trout, what a great career. I just remember being interviewed early on, and I said, if I can have half the career my dad had, I'd still have a pretty darn good baseball career. Well, that was a self-fulfilling prophecy, actually, because about half. But close to equal time, so what does that say? But, you know, we had, just think, you know, Ted Williams would be at the house casually. It's in a great picture of Ted in this book. And guys like No Neck Walt Williams, Pete Ward, Bill Gleason, Jerome Holtzman, Bill Veeck, Gene Bossert, the grounds crew even. Dad would bring home the grounds crew at midnight to play horseshoes after a night game. They'd have the car lights on the stakes, and they would have a barbecue going. It never stopped. And just, so I was lucky to have that connection. I mean, when I was a kid, Comiskey Park was my playground. We used to go in the dugout and call the lady in the switchboard. He still had the old switchboard, and we'd order a pizza, and, oh, stop calling us. We're busy up here. And just hit the button, the basket would come up behind home plate. So that was my playground. So when I got there finally in 78 from Birmingham, Alabama in AA, I felt a little bit at home. I didn't, it wasn't such an thing, although my first batter was Butch Weiniger. I struck him out. I didn't even know how I did it, but I did it. Rod Carew came up. He had a fly ball, and they asked me after the game what it was like pitching against Rod Carew. And I said, for $116 a day, I'd pitch against Jesus himself. And I went, oh, okay. That's when I think they put the seven-second thing on radio shows. I don't know about that.
But that's so, pretty calm today. That's pretty calm today. That comment.
Oh yeah, for sure. But I was very lucky, and along the way, the great road that I took, the journey was met so many great people, and here I get to sit up and be part of today, and still be involved in the game. I do so many different things. I work with senior citizens in a baseball game that we have for them, and also buddy ball, handicapped kids, and I coach in Philippines, I coached in Colombia, I've coached all over the world just about, and today I still do a lot of baseball work, so, you know, it's great to be here, and I mean, we're not leaving quite yet, but, you know, with Barry and Joe and all of you, so, yeah, we can just keep talking about.
I think just to put it in some context, too, you know, since Stottlemyre was involved in the story, I was just at Yankee Stadium last Saturday. And the Yankees surprised him by giving him a plaque that they now hung in Monument Park along the same day as Willie Randolph. Both of them wore the same number, 30. And when you look at Stottlemyre and the era that Steve came, his dad, yeah, I was looking at Stottlemyre's numbers. And, you know, this poor guy, he's had a disease called multiple myeloma, which is a cancer of the blood system that attacks your bones. And usually the mean length of lifetime of people who have this disease is 5 years. Well, to show you what a battler Stottlemyre has always been, he's now in his 16th year and at 73, still battling. And in his career, and these are, you know, ballpark numbers, it's not particularly precise, but he won 163 games in 10 years for the Yankees, started 350, threw 150 complete games, and then 40 shutouts. And this is the kind of thing that guys did back then. I just did this column on the A's of 1980, and you probably remember this team. They had 94 complete games in 1980. Billy Martin, basically, it was my early years as a sports writer out in the Bay Area. Four of them pitched four 14-inning complete games. I went to three of them, and in my mind's eye, I always wanted to write a story about it. And Steve McCaddy is the pitching coach of the Nationals, and you know, we sat down and talked about it. And there was no pitch counts back then; they're not even in the box scores. If you go back to Baseball Reference and look for a pitch count from 1980, there aren't any. So I said, "Well, do you know how many pitches you threw in that 14-inning game?" And he said, yeah, you know, it was like 203, 210. And because Matt Keogh, Billy used to have the next day's pitcher sit and chart the pitches. That's the only reason he knew. And then it was never recorded anywhere else. And his line, and you could probably identify with this, was nobody knew about Tommy John surgery back then except Tommy John. So, Steve, how did you guys pitch and get through what you did, throw complete games without pitch counts and the nursing they do of pitchers now, and all survive?
Hey, I had 100 pitch count in the fifth inning most of the time.
Yeah, but so, I bet you throw 150 a few times, right?
A few times.
Yeah.
I really think it came from a smart agent. I think a lot of it did. I think it came from, well, it might have came, you know, I Kerry Wood in high school had pitched so many had so many pitches. I think the Cubs were going to draft him, and they were concerned that might have hurt his arm. So maybe that kind of trickled into some of it in the last 10 years when he signed in 2000. Or so. Anyways, yeah, no, I believe even going six innings with three runs or less was a quality start. We laughed at that. Like, that's not a quality start. That's a 5 ERA. That's a terrible start.
Yeah.
And now you have it where guys are going six innings, you know, and they're able to use that in their into their quality start statistics and things like this. And I just don't agree with that as being a quality start. I do think maybe an agent probably said, hey, look, in order to further your career and my ability to make 5% on your money, let's implement these type of ideas, and then guys start going with it. And I just think they're conserving way too much. I mean, there's pitching coaches, one from Atlanta, who had guys throwing two bullpens in between starts. And all he wanted to do is throw the ball. Just throw the ball. The more you're throwing the ball, the better. So to me, the pitch count is overrated. And I just get tired of hearing, and I love Ron Coomer and Pat Hughes. They're my favorite. But I just get tired of hearing, well, his pitch count's up to about 91. Well, that's not that many pitches. My dad pitched 352 innings in 1 year. All they did is they put their arm up on a wall. They got somebody, or they rubbed it like this. We call milking the arm, and it bounced back in 2 days. So I don't know, but I think it's just, I think it was done by the agents.
Yeah, well, Sandy Koufax, in his last year, and he was one of the few guys who had a, you know, pronounced arm injury, but in 1966, when his arm was basically falling off and they were using strange lineaments on it so he could pitch, he threw like 300 innings and, you know, won 20-something game. And by the time he finished the World Series that year, his arm was ready to fall off, and he just basically said, I'm going to have arthritis in this, and I'm not going to be able to use my arm if I don't stop pitching, and that's why he retired. But just to take the myth of Sid Finch even further, just to, you know, basically in your mind, how many pitches would Sid Finch have been able to throw in a game?
Good question.
Well, I never actually threw a pitch.
You're George Plimpton now, Joe.
Well, I mean, George and I played catch, but right. It wasn't.
Writing part two of the Sid Finch story.
I've got a rather frightening day coming up. You know, and August 26th is Sid Finch Day at Brooklyn's. Any of you from Brooklyn? You know, Brooklyn Cyclones. Come out. I mean, they've got bobbleheads and all this stuff with Sid Finch bobblehead.
Well, you know, and of course, you know, the Sid Finch bobblehead looks like Joe Burton.
Yeah, for a make-believe guy, I'm sure having a lot of fun with it. But they talked about me throwing out the first pitch. And, oh, well, we'll make it look like it you got some speed to it. I'm thinking, you know, right now I'm only good for about a 98-mile-an-hour changeup. So it's just...
Or as, you know, I said to Reggie the other day, you know, in the wind tunnel that's the new Yankee Stadium, he was taking batting practice for the old Timers game. And I said to him, so in your heyday, Reggie, how many home runs do you think you would hit here? And he goes, oh, probably 20 or 30. And I go, really, that's all? He goes, well, I'm 68 years old. And I said, well, I purposefully said heyday, Reggie. So, I mean, I knew you were going to answer that. So and then he said, I'd probably hit 40 or 50 here, and he probably would have. I mean, even in the old stadium, which had the same dimensions, he had a lot of home runs. But Yankee Stadium now, you hit a pop fly, and it's a home run. And that's another thing that pitchers have to deal with, you know, when they go into those kind of ballparks. So I think an interesting part of your story, too, Joe, is that tell the people how much money you actually made for doing this whole shtick.
Well, there are many of you out there who'd love to do it and not be concerned about money, so I never really was. But my day rate was just a photographer's assistant, which is about $110 or something. So, and then since it became such a big deal, it was always the extra goodies I loved, like the invitation to the Sportsman of the Year banquet at the... You know, so here's Merlin Olsen and Mary Lou Retton, you know, Lincoln Center, and, you know, well, Joe, get there by 6 at the, you know, we'll take limousines over. And I'm down there with black tie and waiting for limousines, and it's, you guys would love it because it was like real live baseball, football, hockey cars and stuff. So, and Rocky Blyer I'm standing with, he was a very friendly guy, so he's got his rings. And Lane had shot his hand with the championship rings. We had a photographer to talk about in common. And then they're throwing us into limousines. And well, Sid, you ride over with Brooks and Earl. hey, Sid. Brooks, Earl, Sid.
Yes. So basically, when you're in these events, they just call you Sid, right?
They only know me as Sid. But I did my best to lobby for Ron Santo's place in the Hall of Fame with Brooks. I figured I better, you know, make use of my ride over there. And then that, so the event is being televised on HBO, and you go in there, and there's like the Oscars where you got your name on the seats and where you're going to sit, and they're coming up. But, well, Sid, you know, when we introduce you on camera, you know, there'll be a camera right there. Don't, you know, I'm thinking, oh, I get to do my hi mom moment. So they're showing video highlights of that year. Now, the Royals, Brent Saberhage and Charlie Lee Brandt, Charlie's from Loyola Academy here, the Royals ended up winning the World Series that year. So they're making a big deal about them. And then they cut to a video clip of me in St. Petersburg and something like, well, these guys wouldn't have had a chance if Sid decided to play baseball. Here I'm sitting in an audience that's huge, and I'm seeing me in big screen thinking, yeah, this is kind of crazy. And then, sure enough, the cameraman comes up. So the event is fantastic. We go to dinner, so assigned seats. Sportsman of the Year that year, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. So the Lakers are playing the Knicks that day. Kareem's running late. My seatmates, Mr. and Mrs. Lou Alcindor, Ina Slaughter, Tug McGraw. So I had a whole, you ask about money. I've been rewarded tremendously by many events like that.
And for you, because, you know, the 1980s was obviously the first years of after free agency, which was instituted after a long fight in 1977 in Major League Baseball. How much did you make for the Cubs when you went from the White Sox to the Cubs in 1983 to 1984?
Minimum salary was, I remember, $117 a day when I got called up. From I had won my arbitration case against the new owners, Jerry Reinsdorf and Eddie Einhorn, and I think that's why they end up trading me. But anyways, we walked out of the arbitration case, and I said to the arbitrator, hey, Reggie Jackson said I was the best left-hander he's ever faced. My agent said, I think you just won the case for us. A few days later, the verdict came, and I was going to be paid $275,000 from, I think it was $150,000 the year before. So the arbitration is where the salaries just skyrocketed. In probably the mid-80s, did you start seeing baseball salaries just get to a point now where, you know, it's whatever it is, good or bad. I wish I was playing now, though.
Yeah, I think the average baseball salary is $3 million now, and the minimum is $550,000, something like that.
Yeah, our meal money was, I think, $17 a day. Yeah, I do remember. Again, it goes back to that interview. Yeah, for $116 a day, I sure would pitch. But gosh, you know, even spring training, if you got to spring training and you're a minor leaguer, that spring training money lasted you till the middle of June. I mean, you could hold on to it. And we were stealing soup cans from the major league, you know, soup kitchen training, you know, the cooking area. We did whatever we could because in the minor league, still to this day, they make very little money. There's some benefit, but it's a tough business in the minor league.
So what was it like to play on the 84 Cubs, which was the first Cub team to go to the playoffs after they lost the 1945 World Series to the Tigers?
As Ned Colletti wrote a book about that, the year that Ivy smiled, and Ned, of course, is with the Dodgers now. Oh, my goodness, we had no clue that we were going to do as well as we did in spring training until all of a sudden things started shaping up, and Gary Matthews came over with that leadership quality, and Bobby Dunier came over with center field defense that we hadn't seen before. And to me, that was a team. And then, of course, Eckersley and Sutcliffe come over from Cleveland, and then Ron Hassey, even as a great backup catcher. And I was always believing in Dallas Green, and always just, I loved the Philadelphia people. They had this attitude. It was a little harsher attitude, a little more about baseball and winning, and that's what it's about in the big leagues. So to me, it was just a great year. Of course, my dad pitched against the Cubs in 1945, and we had won the first two games in the playoffs, as you know. So it was going to be his son going back to pitch against the Tigers now, all those years later. And crazy things happened in San Diego. That was the biggest letdown I've ever had, and probably most of the 84 guys I've ever had. It just didn't work out. It was too bad.
Well, Boa and the books I wrote basically said that coming from Chicago to San Diego in between games, first of all, in that series, you guys got screwed because you didn't have lights on Wrigley, so you lost the home field advantage. The first two games were played in Wrigley during the day, and then two out of the last three were moved to San Diego so they could play them on weekend nights. Actually, it was a Thursday night and Saturday night, and the last game was Sunday afternoon. And then also, the games were played with replacement umpires because the umpires were on strike. And by the time you got back to San Diego, the replacement umpires were gone, and the regular umpires were back. And Boa basically said there was guys on the plane, family, people were drinking wine. It's like they felt like they were talking about the World Series. Then Jim Fry set up the rotation to have like Sutcliffe pitch on Sunday just in case you guys won on Saturday night, he'd be ready for the World Series. And it's like win the playoffs first, pitch him on set. Boa is still pissed about this 30 years later that Fry didn't pitch Sutcliffe on Saturday night. And then of course there's the Sunday game where the ball goes through Durham's legs in San Diego. Sutcliffe blows a 3-0 lead anyway. Gwynn hits a ball that hits something in the infield that takes a hop over Sandberg's shoulders. And at this point, you go, this just isn't fated. This is the Cubs' face at this point. And the Padres, it turns out, this is their only one of two pennants. And, you know, you look at, without the Padres' history is worse than the Cubs. No World Series. They've been to the World Series twice, never won. No-hitters, no cycle. Nobody's ever hit for the cycle. I just read the other day that Tampa Bay passed them. They've got the worst record of any baseball team now in history. This is the Padres' history, and the Cubs haven't won since, 1908. It's like immovable forces, and that series turned out to be one of the greats in history, for the Padres. But you know the story, Sandberg dumping the Gatorade on Durham's glove.
On his glove.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it happened, and I if it changed the weight of the glove or what, but oh my goodness, you think about that, and then the ball over Sandberg's head, that was another one, and Jay Johnstone's in the bullpen, or I think I'm in the bullpen warming up, and Jay Johnstone, someone's waiting, hey, Fry, he's ready, Trout's ready, get him in there, and then they just wait a little bit long, but I think having Sut pitch on Sunday was a major mistake. I mean, he should have pitched on Saturday. And whether you use Sanderson or not to say anything bad about, or you threw me on Sunday, which could have been great, or mix, me go, Sanderson could start, I'll be ready, whoever's ready, we all come on board to win the final game. I'm not sure if it was something that was planned so that Rick could pitch first game in the World Series.
Well, that's Fry said.
Or Boa said.
No, and Fry said it too.
Then... Yeah, that even pisses me off more. So,
well, and to put it into context, in this amalgam of a team that Dallas puts together, he gets Sutcliffe in June of that season from the Indians, and Sutcliffe only goes 16-1 during the regular season. And game one here in Wrigley, it's 13-1. They win, so he's 17-1. He hits a home run in that game, and then he holds them for the Sunday game just in case they win on Saturday night. As you know, that's where you talk about great managerial decisions in history.
I think I don't know if this is what is in Fry or Boa's book, but I think the intricacy of that is, if I'm not mistaken, I think Rick might have said, look, I want to open up in Detroit, so...
It might be,
yeah,
sure.
So throw me Sunday if we don't win Saturday because I can't lose, something like this. I think that might have been what truly transpired in the room, and some of the guys were very upset that I was not getting a second start. Very upset.
And you did come into that Sunday game.
I did come in, and it was, but
it was too late.
Yeah, it was a little bit too late.
Yeah.
And geez, Boy, that was a long flight back, that's for sure. But as far as the wine on the flights, that was like all the flights. I don't know. I'm not sure if that was just that one going to San Diego or not.
Well, you know, both.
But what I kind of blame it on Mike Royko. You know, I love his writing.
Oh, yeah.
He was the best. But he wrote an article about the wine sipping, Zinfandels, cheese-eating, finical fans of San Diego that they'll leave in the fifth inning. And so I go to the rent-a-car. Get a car, and I see Royko's article. Go to a restaurant, I see Royko's article. It fired up all of those San Diego fans where they had a vengeance for to come out and support the team. So I said, Mike Royko, why did you write that article? But, you know, so...
And that's true, because when the Padres came back from Chicago that night, in the middle of the night, there were like 25,000 people in the parking lot at Jack Murphy Stadium at the time waiting for them.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it was just an impromptu pep rally that pushed them forward. And the Padres starting pitching and the whole postseason was awful. But Ed Whitson in Game 7 beat you like 7-1. And that was the only win they had from a starter in the whole postseason. All right, well, let me go to some questions here before we wrap up. I've got a number of them here. This is for Sid, quote unquote. Were the Met players really ashen with fear after seeing you under the tent?
Well, like I said, I didn't really have to throw. But the young guys were all into the possibility they could be in Sports Illustrated. So they didn't really care that it was a fake story. Is this going to be in the magazine? You know, so they were just all into that, and but no, I did not strike fear into any batter.
did everybody on the team know what was going on?
No, not at all. You know, we hung out with the young guys, the guys trying to make the team. We wanted to go unnoticed. We wanted to be as unnoticed as you could be walking around with a French horn, I guess. But we didn't want some national reporter covering the Mets saying what's going on over there. So if we were hanging out with the 20, 22-year-olds trying to make the team, Gary Carter and his crew, I mean, the Mets were really pretty stacked. You had some Hernandez and...
pitching staff was...
The pitching staff was
Ron
really good.
Darling, yeah. And Sid Fernandez, yeah. And Gooden, and, you know, this was their seminal pitching staff. This was the one year in their history where the Mets actually had decent hitting and decent pitching at the same time. You know, 69 when they won, they had pretty good hitting and great pitching, and that team was made by a late-season move that got Don Clendenin from the Pirates, and he basically played first base and helped them win. But, you know, but the 86 Mets were at that era, they probably should have won more, but there's a whole other story about how that team decomposed with drug problems and all kinds of stuff and didn't last.
The big guys came on really later, and, you know, by that April 1st game, everybody on the Mets were really into it.
Steve, do you have a favorite Bill Veeck story?
Well, one night we were out at Miller's Pub, and it was about 2 a.m., and this is not the case. It was at a party, and the host of the party said, to Bill, who wanted another beer, that they were out of beer. And Bill said, well, if you're out of beer, you're out of Bill. We're going to Miller's Pub. It's open till 4. well, actually, this, you know, he was a great friend of my dad's. And the one story about Bill was in the main office, Harry Chappis, who was our Greek shortstop, he was about 5'6". He must have cost me 5 hits that year because he couldn't catch the ball as easy as Don Kessinger could have. But anyways, so I go in, and I'm calling season ticket holders to renew their season tickets, and they said, well, not if you're pitching, we're not going to renew. So I get to my phone, start dialing up, and I go for lunch, and there's Harry Chappis, and there's this contract. It's about 6 feet long and 4 feet high, and it said the biggest contract for the littlest amount to the smallest player. And that was, and Harry was going to sign it, and that's one of Bill Veeck's promotional pieces with a player. And he said, well, my God, There's 250,000 Greeks that live down the street. We have to have a Greek shortstop. So that was one of them. But, you know, the thing I loved about Bill, he took his door off the hinges and said, my door is always open to everybody. He had his phone. He had his name in the phone book. You could call him. He was just truly a great man. And Mike Vec, I have some great stories about Mike as well. But, yeah, so that's just one of them.
Did you ever go up to the barge room?
Oh, so many times. They had the ticker tape, and they had Bill and Joe. You know, you've been up there so many times, and players would go up there, but not too often. It was really for the writers and for Bill Vec to hold court.
Well, to explain what it was to the to people who might not know.
It was a room that had a ticker tape that would come in, so you could read all the scores during from other games. It had a bar with a keg. It had baseball memorabilia and these deep, dark red seats. You remember, Joe, and probably maybe 15 tables, and that's where people would come after the game, and they would just be able to sit down and tell baseball stories. You have a couple, don't you, Joe?
Yeah, we were doing a story, this before Sid, but we were covering the 83 White Sox, and they had a good starting staff that year right after right after you left.
Right after I left, they had a great team.
I don't mean that to sound as it came out. But part of the deal with taking photographs, Vec said, well, come on upstairs. So, I mean, all you hear about is the Bard's Room, and here suddenly we're going to enter into it. And Frank DeFord was a writer on that story, and another great baseball writer to visit if you're into fantastic literature. And there's Bill and Frank DeFord holding court, and DeFord would always wear these pastel type colors suits and wonderful stuff. But Bill Vec, when he left the Sox, you'd see him at Wrigley Field. So my brother and I, we would go to Ray's bleachers and then Murphy's at the time. But if you got there early enough, Vec would be in back by the picnic tables, and you know, he'd be sitting there having a drink and smoking, and on his peg leg, he had a little ashtray built into it.
Right.
he'd have his legs crossed. He'd just be flicking his little cigarette.
Basically, he spent the last years of his life watching
Cubs games.
The
bleachers. Yeah. And he
always sat in the bleachers.
Like Steve said, he was just so approachable. You can go up, we could talk anytime.
I was on Waveland coming from I ran down to the lake and I was coming back, and I'm getting very close to Wrigley, and I see this guy wobbling, sort of lifting his right leg up and just moving along. And I get up closer, and oh, my goodness, it's Bill. So I stop. I say, hey, Bill, my goodness. Hi, what are you doing? He goes, I'm going to go to the ball game, sit up in the bleachers. And I said, who are you here with? He goes, I'm just going to go by myself. I said, well, should I leave you a ticket? No, I don't know. Anyway, so that's what he would do.
Yeah.
He would go and sit with the fans, and he was truly... their history goes a long way with the Cub. You know, back in 1925, I guess Bill's father owned the team, I think, or something like this.
So I'm putting you on the spot.
Was president of the Cubs? Okay.
So putting you on the spot here, what was more fun, the White Sox or the Cubs?
Daytime baseball. That to me, daytime baseball is the best part of it. The White Sox had better fights in the stands. The Cubs had much more beautiful women in the bleachers, I have to say. So, daytime baseball. Now you have 56 night games. I wish the Cubs would go back to the more daytime baseball, but it'll probably keep going. Obviously, I think there's more revenue to be done with the night games and big, giant scoreboards, but that's okay.
Here's another one for you, and you can talk about the Yankees here. One of our fans asked, what were your first impressions of Steinbrenner when you got traded to the Yankees?
Boy, George got me over there after I had pitched two complete game shutouts for the Cubs. I was pitching the best baseball of my life. I was really feeling so great. And then when I got traded on Sunday before the All-Star break, in the eighth inning, they called me in from the dugout in Wrigley and said, hey, we traded you to New York. I immediately went into the stall area to cry, which is true, because I didn't want to leave Chicago. And the thought of that just, it affected me. I get to New York, George gives me, and I didn't really see him until maybe a couple of weeks later, and he had a giant bottle of champagne for me. He said, "This is for your birthday present." He tried to make me feel at home, but one game in particular, I pitched six innings. In the seventh inning, a ball was dropped by Cotto. I walked a guy. It was an error, another error. I think I walked another guy, and then Benitez came up and hit a home run, a grand slam. Pinella comes out, takes me out of the game. I go into the locker room. I got my jersey off, and in comes a man running in a business suit. I thought it was one of my death threats because I led the team in death threats that year. And it turns out to be George Steinbrenner. And he said, "You should have won that game today if it wasn't for Cotto and it wasn't for Meacham." And I said, "No, George, Meacham made a good play. He tried to go to third base, but he said he should have went to second." I'm just trying to save Meacham's job at this particular point. But that's the kind of guy he was. He was compassionate. He was a wonderful person to the fans, and he was loyal to the people around him. And I felt bad for him because I did not do my job, and I got to New York, and I did not pitch well at all. Heck, after 2 years later, I was struggling just to make a ball club, and I ended up in Seattle. But George, to me, was a classic owner and just a great person for baseball overall.
All right, let's finish this up with this question, and I'm not sure what this means, but here's the question that's for you, Joe. Where are Sid Finch's feet? I'm not sure what that means.
Well, I think down below. You know, the feet, the picture, the opening spread shows me with my foot prominently, toes spread out, and the story generated several thousand letters to the editor. And outside of a swimsuit issue, I mean, that's when you had to actually write a letter or type it, and you know, some of you here probably have never done that. But so actual physical letters, and we got three from foot doctors saying, "We know what's wrong with Sid's feet. Here's enclosed is my business card if he wants to get those toes fixed. They're a natural size 14. They just look a little awkward when you're winding back and your toes spread out and you're barefoot. But it's as far as I know, they're still functioning and in good shape."
Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for being here. Steve Trout, Sid Finch, Reed, Joe Burton.
Thank
I'm Barry Blum.
Much.